Hello again, I'm Armin Alny, and this is the To The Point podcast. We're talking foreign policy today with the added attraction of Nicholas Kristof. Whatever you think, he says 2017 was the best year ever. We'll talk to him later on. First, the U.S. has laid claim to world leadership since the end of World War II, but now, with the administration of Donald Trump, America is abdicating from institutions and frameworks that have formed American foreign policy for nearly three-quarters of a century. That's according to Richard Haass. He's a veteran diplomat, now president of the Council on Foreign Relations. We still have the world's strongest economy. We still have the world's strongest military, he says. But we simply don't think it's worth it. We don't want to do it anymore. Abdicating from world leadership, that is strong stuff. But Richard Haass isn't alone. We'll start our conversation with David Rothkopf. He's a senior fellow at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins, also a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and former editor of Foreign Policy magazine. David Rothkopf, good to have you.
Good to be here.
Why is abdicating a good word?
I think the rationale for offering up the word abdicating is that it implies that we had the power and that we've given up the power. And I think that's one way to look at it. I think an equally persuasive case could be made for the word retreating, where it's not just giving up power. It's actually pulling back from our engagements around the world. But no matter where you are on the political spectrum, you cannot look at the situation the United States is in right now and fail to see the giant question mark that's hanging over us as a country. Will we be more or less powerful in the future? Will we be more or less engaged in the future? I think it's not just the Trump presidency, but the Bush presidency, the Obama presidency, and the Trump presidency that collectively have made that question mark something that every single world leader sees.
So is Donald Trump then part of a continuum rather than something that's completely indifferent and utterly different?
I don't think those are mutually exclusive. I think that the U.S. has been floundering in search of a global role since the end of the Cold War. And, you know, George W. Bush, with the invasion of Iraq, which was a ghastly mistake, alienated much of the world and produced a backlash overseas and at home. Barack Obama said, okay, we're not going to go there again, tried to take a lighter touch, the leading from behind approach, pulled back, was seen as not a particularly strong, engaged U.S. Leader. And Trump has continued much of that with letting, you know, the Russians and the Iranians have their way in Syria, as did Obama, or, you know, staying out of a lot of things, not being terribly engaged in international institutions. But Trump goes beyond that. Trump's not like the others. He has zero foreign policy experience, which, you know, is even less than most presidents, and most presidents don't have much. He is erratic. He's conducting his foreign policy by social media. He lashes out. He's, you know, in my view, clearly unfit to be president of the United States. And so, you know, the policies that he's carrying forward, or that his administration, you know, the State Department, Defense Department, and NSC are offering up, they're kind of a continuation of where we've been. But the president, he's in his own zip code.
So, didn't he, though, run on the platform that he was going to change everything and shake everything up? Is there any surprise about this? Should we simply have expected this, anticipated it, and learned to live with it?
He said he was going to do all these things, and he said he was going to shake things up, and he's certainly shaking things up. But I have to say, you know, I mean, there are degrees, you know. I mean, you can shake things up because they're not working very well and you need to fix them. That's a good thing. Or you can shake things up like crazy, you know, because, you know, without any kind of rationale and make the world a more dangerous place. He's certainly doing the latter. And so, you know, to suggest we should just sort of settle down, and if he said he was going to shake it up, let him shake it up. That's crazy. This guy is making our enemies stronger and America weaker with every irrational tweet he sends out. He has brought us to the brink of nuclear conflict for the first time since the Cuban Missile Crisis. He has undermined our alliances. He has, I think, measurably made the Middle East a more dangerous place. He has not pushed back on clear aggression on the part of the Russians and interference in our own elections. If he were to get a foreign policy grade right now, it'd be an F minus.
F minus. Well, you're not an academic, so but I presume you're well qualified to give out a grade. But if you get an F minus, you don't get to stay. And in this case, we don't believe that we're going to see impeachment, at least not anytime soon. That's really strong language. I want to get back to you, particularly on the question of making us more dangerous. But you indicated that he has undermined our allies and our alliances. The historic special relationship with Britain has made it first among America's allies in Europe and elsewhere. So let's go to London. Leslie Vinjamori is director of the Center on Conflict, Rights and Justice at the University of London. She's also a member of Chatham House and London's Royal Institute of International Affairs. Great to have you on our program. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you.
Does it look from your point of view as if the United States is abdicating its leadership of the rest of the world?
Well, it does look like its engagement with the rest of the world is erratic and a little bit toxic at times. And it's leading, but it's not really seeking to lead with any partners or in any reliable way that Europe or certainly the UK can work with. And you know, if you look across Europe, the UK, certainly Theresa May, has wanted very much to work with this president. The people in the UK don't necessarily feel the same, and Parliament doesn't necessarily feel the same, but there is a desire, certainly on the leadership, to work with the United States, and it's been tremendously difficult. So I think abdication is, you know, one word that you could choose. The U.S. is still clearly very engaged abroad. It's just engaged in a different way than it has been in the past, and not one that goes over well at all in Europe.
It is astounding to me that there are people now in the United Kingdom who are saying that President Trump should not be allowed to visit, or that if he does visit, he shouldn't be allowed to meet the Queen.
Well, I mean, is it really astounding? If you think about a number of the actions that have taken place in the last several months, I think it's actually not so surprising. After the Borough Market attacks and the Westminster attacks, the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, tried in the best of British traditions to keep people calm. He tweeted, and the reaction from the President of the United States of America was to be dismissive, to be aggressive in response to the mayor of London, right in the back of domestic terrorist attack. Unsurprisingly, in fact, the public had a very negative reaction to that. And then, of course, not long after, if you recall, Donald Trump retweeted the anti-Muslim videos that were not even correct in terms of what they were claiming to capture that had come off the Twitter feed of Britain First, a far-right party that's largely discredited in the UK, again at a time when much of the conversation domestically in the UK is about trying to push back on racism, on targeting Muslims. So very toxic way of sort of throwing a lightning rod into the middle of really sensitive issues, politically sensitive issues in the UK. So unsurprisingly, it hasn't gone down well with the public. It didn't go down well in Parliament. It led to a lot of discussion about whether or not a state visit should ever take place, certainly led to a deferral of that visit. And it's a very contentious topic, and it will be quite an intense environment when Donald Trump turns up, which I imagine he will.
You mentioned the mayor of London. He, of course, is a Muslim, the first time that the mayor of London has been a Muslim. Do you think that has something to do with the anger at people when President Trump was so dismissive of him?
Well, I think that it's been a very positive force in London. It's been tremendously important, I think, at a time when there has been a concern that a certain very targeted politics could undermine the cohesiveness of society. And there's been a real push to through Sadiq Khan, and his identity, I think, is central to this, to really unite Londoners and to unite the UK. Remember, of course, this is all in the context of a vote to exit the European Union, which is seen by many people as being, you know, a vote that was a vote that was anti-immigrant, that was anti-Muslim, that was about things other than just Europe. And so to then have an American president who stokes those fires very unhelpfully and from the outside and already with an image that isn't well received amongst the public, I think has been has really worked against the ability of Theresa May to try and extend a hand to forge a partnership with the new president at a time when she needs that partnership perhaps more than she's ever needed it before.
Leslie Benjamore, once again, a member of Chatham House and England's Royal Institute of International Affairs. David Rothkopf, back to you. What do you mean when you say that all of what we're hearing from you and from Ms. Benjamore is making America more making things more dangerous for the United States?
Well, look, I mean, there are many ways to evaluate that. First of all, when our standing is weakened, our leverage goes down. When we pull back from difficult areas, we leave it to opportunists to step in, whether it's the Russians and the Iranians in Syria or, you know, the Chinese and a host of other places around the world. We appear to be erratic, even our allies don't know whether they can depend on us. When the president is erratic and then his senior cabinet officials tend to be, you know, undoing what he does with every statement. So the president says we're not going to give money to the Palestinians, and then a couple days later the State Department says, yeah, but maybe we will. The president says no to, you know, LGBT soldiers in the military, and the military says, well, no, actually, we're going to do that. They're left confused. So our allies don't know whether they can depend on us. That weakens our alliances. Our enemies see opportunities to take advantage of us. Our standing is going down. We have less leverage. And then there are other things that are institutional where we're gutting our diplomatic corps. And so, you know, that's not just a momentary thing that's undone with the next election. It takes years to train these people. And as you gut the corps and as people resign from the diplomatic corps, we're going to go through a period of 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 12 years where we have to hire new people, retrain them, familiarize them with the issues, get them out there. And so on level after level after level, this presidency is eating away like an acid at the foundations of American leadership.
What about the argument that the president makes again and again that, in fact, what you refer to as American leadership is, in fact, more expensive than it's worth it, whether it's keeping troops in other countries or providing assistance to the Palestinians, for example. And is there, do you think, in the United States, a real movement toward the idea of withdrawing from the world? Is the president, do you think, isolationist?
Yeah, I think he's an isolationist. There's no question about it. He doesn't want to be engaged overseas unless it, you know, is a trip where, you know, people roll out the red carpet and throw him a big dinner party. But, you know, he's also a hypocrite, you know, because he says things like, I don't want to spend a lot of money on engagement overseas. Well, the one really, really big area where we spend money on our overseas engagement is defense. And he has said he wants to spend more money on defense. And I think one could make a case we should spend less. We spend more than the next 12 or 13 or 14 countries added up. And most of them are our allies. So I think we could save money there. He doesn't want to do that. As far as other kinds of money that we spend overseas, aid or money that we spend to the UN, well, that's a fraction of what even other countries do as a percentage of GDP. In fact, we spend less on foreign aid as a percentage of GDP than any other country in the OECD, that is to say, any other developed country. So we're not spending a lot on this. But I think the most important point is he doesn't really get why we're doing it. He seems to think that when we spend money on the NATO alliance, we're paying purely for the protection of those other countries.
But of course, the NATO alliance was created because it was in our interest. Europe was going to be a buffer between us and the Russians. In fact, the Europeans were going to be the ones who were on the front lines should something happen with the Russians, and they were putting themselves at stake, and we were benefiting from that. And he doesn't understand that, you know, these national security deals are, you know, like deals that should take place in the business world, which is to say both sides benefit. And that, you know, I think is the biggest problem of them all, because if the United States has one thing that sets it apart from other countries, it's alliances. We have a network of alliances worldwide that gives us a kind of power and a kind of an institutional memory of what our strength could, should, and would be in the event of a crisis that no other country has.
We're talking with David Rothkopf. This is To the Point. Leslie Vinjamori, back to you. What does Europe, what does England and the other countries of Europe get from the alliance with the United States? How do you respond to what we just heard from Mr. Rothkopf about President Trump's view that it's all going in one direction?
Well, I mean, there's so many components, especially if you're talking about the U.S.-UK relationship. Obviously, NATO is important, tremendously important to Europe's security, and that's perceived to be tremendously important. But the relationship is far deeper in the U.K. The intelligence sharing is tremendously important, but that is a two-way relationship. America benefits from that intelligence sharing, as does the UK, and I don't think that there's a genuine risk of that actually unraveling. I think it continues to be very robust. There have been moments in this last nearly 1 year now when it seemed fraught, but I think it has continued to be actually a very robust relationship, primarily because the people working on this relationship are, you know, working at multiple layers, and they've been there a long time, and they're continuing to remain committed in the face of grave, a context of grave uncertainty and seeming irrationality. But there are cultural dimensions, there are all sorts of dimensions to the relationship. So I think that the strength of the relationship over the long term is likely to remain intact. The problem is at the question of policy, and it's at the level of policy, it's at the level of diplomacy, and it's very much, as I mentioned earlier, it's at the level of how the publics are responding to not only the American president, but how it's affecting their image of America. And if you look back at the Pew data that came out last summer, you know, the numbers are just atrocious, down 57%. In the UK, the image of the American president, and that is directly impacting how people here view not only the president, but also how they view the United States, how they view American democracy. Remember, a lot of what matters in American foreign policy isn't just the ability to collaborate on specific policies, but it's America's soft power, and people are not favorable towards American democracy right now. They're concerned about the effect, the spillover effect that it is having and what could have on Europe. So I think there are a number of dimensions, some of which have remained intact, and others that are being very considerably and negatively impacted by contemporary politics.
You say that things should be okay in the long term. What do you know about high-level meetings of diplomats from European nations and other allies when they get together? Where is the United States on the agenda?
Well, I think there's an ongoing conversation about how to work with the United States, what the implications are. There hasn't been a very strategic, I think for many months, people were surprised. They were almost shocked at what was coming out of Washington, as much the level, not so much policy, but at the level of style of engagement, which is just not something that people are used to seeing. It's really beyond the pale, I think, for how most Europeans approach their lives and certainly how European diplomats approach diplomacy. So I think there was a sort of almost a sense of disarray in how to respond. We're now moving into a period where I think European diplomats and certainly European leaders are thinking more strategically. And we see this, of course, we saw this today with Macron's trip to China. It's quite extraordinary, really, to watch. A sort of move to form deeper relationships amongst themselves, to form stronger bilateral partnerships elsewhere, to include America, of course, but to be hesitant and reluctant to invest, to overly invest in that relationship, and to look for other friends and partners.
We've mentioned tweets. We haven't talked about any in specific terms. And also, of course, the president makes public statements. David Rothkopf, you mentioned Korea very briefly. Here's something that the president had to say with regard to the fact that North and South Korea, for the first time in a couple of years, now are, in fact, having talks about the Winter Olympics. And here's the president's take on that.
Without my rhetoric and without my tough stance, and it's not just a stance, I mean, this is what has to be done, if it has to be done, that they wouldn't be talking about Olympics, that they wouldn't be talking right now.
Leslie Benjamori in London, how do diplomats take a statement like that? How do you take it?
The claim that, you know, all good things come from Donald Trump. I mean, I think that people are at this point are quite used to this. They sort of understand intuitively how the president, how he responds, how he reacts, how he needs to be able to claim success. What we're not seeing actually is any clear thinking on how to capitalize on that fact. The president does need to be able to claim success. So, you know, why not find a strategy that enables him to claim success while allowing others to move forward more strategically? I think that, you know, there's a degree of dismissiveness about it, but the tweets are problematic because they make it very hard to develop to work with the United States, to know exactly, you know, what is policy and what is just bluster and what is emotion and what is rage at CNN or some other news network. So I think that, again, this is where the conversation is now. Do we take the tweets seriously? Do we dismiss them? Do we, you know, is he talking to his base or is he now speaking to us? And it seems, certainly in the new year, since the start of 2018, that the tweets are increasingly aimed at the rest of the world, not just at Americans at home. And then there is a real conversation about, you know, what to do with this. And again, I think it's part of the strategy is to look elsewhere, to invest elsewhere, to invest beyond and outside of the United States.
David Rothkopf, you said earlier that the president has brought us closer to nuclear war than we've been at any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis. What about what he just said, the suggestion that by talking tough with Kim Jong-un, he in fact has caused North Korea to try to change its position with regard to South Korea and actually get together? He's suggesting he's making peace.
It's fatuous nonsense. You know, I mean, the real reason that they started to talk was that the South Koreans didn't trust the U.S. to be an interlocutor anymore. And the president of South Korea said as much. You know, he said the U.S. is the X factor we don't understand, so we're going to go out and reach out to the North Koreans. Secondly, the North Koreans and the South Koreans have had a conversation about whether the North Koreans should attend the Winter Olympics, which they said that they were going to do, and whether they should reopen a hotline, and not much beyond that. The United States is still pushing a point, which Trump has been pushing, for the denuclearization of North Korea, which isn't going to happen. And at the same time, we have to go back to the fact that if Trump says, you know, no testing, no weapons, this is my objective, and I might use weapons to stop North Korea from continuing onward, that the North Koreans will remain jittery and will continue to have to do the saber rattling that they've been doing in order to protect what they see as their equities in this whole thing. So the situation is not less dangerous now than it was a week ago. So the president didn't help that. The talks that took place didn't actually help address this issue. So the president didn't help that. The South Koreans don't think the president's been helpful. And if they don't think so, then who the heck would know better than that? And so I just think, you know, this is just, you know, Trump, you know, this is the Trump living out this this fantasy life that he's got, which is, roughly akin to when a couple of days ago he said, well, we haven't had any, commercial airline fatalities in the past year. That's because of my tough position. And we hadn't had any commercial airline fatalities since 2009. So we hadn't had any throughout the whole entire Obama administration. But does that stop him from taking credit? No, he's delusional.
Back to North Korea and your earlier point that there's a kind of continuity between Mr. Trump and his predecessors. They didn't do anything about North Korea at all, did they? And has Mr. Trump then inherited a situation from them that didn't need to be as fraught as it is?
I think if you were going to go and grade the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, the Obama administration on their management of North Korea's push towards nuclearization, they would all get lousy grades. They negotiated. The North Koreans used their, pursuit of nuclear weapons as a way to get concessions, as a way to get money. And then at a certain point, the North Koreans saw what happened to Muammar Gaddafi when he gave up his nuclear weapons, and they said, no, we've got to push ahead with this thing. And the character of this whole thing has, in the past year or so, changed dramatically as the North Koreans have pushed forward also with their missile program, the ICBM program, the ability to deliver these weapons as far away as the United States. So, once again, does Trump get a pass because Clinton, Bush, and Obama weren't so good at this? No, he doesn't, because he has done something none of them did, which is take us to the edge of nuclear war. He has rejected diplomacy, rejected his State Department at absolutely critical moments throughout this thing. He has alienated the South Koreans in ways that none of his predecessors have done. He has alienated the Japanese in ways that none of his predecessors have done. He has played, by the way, footsie with the Russians throughout this whole thing, who are actually the ones selling, oil to the North Koreans throughout it. So he has no strategy, but he has this inflammatory, impulse-driven approach to this issue, which has made it worse. So, others are bad. He's worse.
David Rothkopf with a very strong point of view with regard to President Trump. We are not making an effort on this program to balance that view with a supporter. I want to go back to Leslie Avengemori, though, in London, and ask you this. There has been in this country, of course, a uproar over Michael Wolff's book, Fire and Fury, with the suggestion that the president is an unstable person, to put it rather gently. Has that made a big splash in London as well?
Well, it's certainly the talk about town. Everybody, if you go out, it's in the last few days, it's certainly the first question that you get asked, certainly if you have an American accent, to talk about politics. It's getting a lot of coverage. But at some level, people, I think, find it, that America's a sort of bizarre place, isn't it? That politics can operate at this level. On the other hand, much of what people are hearing, the excerpts that they're reading, are indications of what they've been hearing for many, many months now. So not clear that it's as different as it seems.
Before we wrap this up, I want to ask you both the same question. And Leslie Avengemori, let me ask you first. If America's role continues to diminish, as you've both indicated, I think it has, you in less strong terms than David Rothkopf, what are the consequences of that, do you think? Leslie Avengemori, you first.
Well, I think one thing is that it's not clear who replaces America. It's very difficult, I think, and this is a question that Europe struggles with. And one of the, I think it's very important to recognize the fact that much of what's happening in the United States is very positive right now. The pushback, the mobilization in parts of organizations like the ACLU, the work of the courts in trying to hold firm on the Muslim ban, all sorts of initiatives that are taking place across cities, across states, on Paris. Unfortunately, a lot of that's not getting the coverage that it's getting within the United States. So people aren't seeing that actually there is a lot of prospect over the long term. There are lots of things going on domestically that lend some optimism over the medium to long term that America will remain a very positive force if we get through this current patch. But if American leadership doesn't, you know, if those longer-term forces don't win out, then I think there's a real question mark. Because it's not, you know, it's not clear who in Europe is going to lead. Europe's in a very difficult place. For a long time, we thought it was Angela Merkel. For a long time, I say, for the first, you know, 7 or 8 months of the Trump presidency, and she was hurt very badly by the elections. Now everybody's looking to the French. But Macron has his own problems domestically. So I think the search is on, and it's not clear in the absence of American leadership who can fill that gap. It's quite clearly the case that regardless how significant China is or may become, it simply can't, doesn't have the domestic constitution to really fill that space of a liberal democratic leader that's going to work multilaterally to promote the liberal values that have been so essential, certainly to Europeans, for multiple decades now. So I think it's a very significant, grave problem that people are existentially worried about, except, of course, that Europeans are tremendously pragmatic.
David Rothkopf, same question to you. If the United States retreats, as you put it, what are the consequences to world order?
Well, I think, you know, typically in periods where there's not an established world order, there is turmoil. And I think that we're likely to enter a period of some turmoil as different powers step up and try to fill the voids that are left by the United States at a regional and at an international level, fill the voids that are left by institutions that have depended on the U.S. for funding and support in order to be effective. And so, consequently, we are going to sort of watch it play out. And I think we're going to see different answers. We're going to see, you know, in certain regional situations, regional hegemons or alliances between regional powers and foreign powers fill the void. And, for example, in the Middle East, the Iranians and the Russians across the northern tier of the Middle East have much more influence than they had in the past, and the U.S. is not counterbalancing that. I think that China is not going to replicate the role the U.S. played, but China, of course, through its economic power, through its Belt and Road Initiative, through its outreach, through trade and investment, and even establishing a foreign military base in Africa now and thinking about others, is going to play a much bigger role in global affairs than it did. And I think we're likely to enter a period in which, if the U.S. continues to decline, you're going to go from the sort of one superpower world that we were in to something that looks a little bit akin to balance of power politics in the past, where you're going to have to play among several major powers in order to resolve things, with a couple of exceptions. The U.S. still has the ability to wage and win global thermonuclear war to a degree no one else does, although no one wins a global thermonuclear war. The U.S. is still the most powerful nation on Earth, and if we ever decide we're going to put our shoulder into something, we're going to be able to make a bigger impression than anybody else. And I think that a lot of the things that Trump has done can be reversed by a subsequent president. And it may be that, you know, a bout of Bush, Obama, and Trump is going to teach the world precisely what they want out of the United States, and that they really feel that there is a stabilizing role for the U.S. to play, and that they may be a little bit nostalgic for a somewhat stronger U.S. We'll have to see who's next, and we'll have to see how that plays out.
Okay, well, thank you both very much for being with us today, David Rothkopf at Johns Hopkins and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Leslie Vinjamori in London at the University of London. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In a moment, an added attraction, Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times. One major feature of this month's welcoming in of the new year has been the hope that we would never have another one like 2017. Dyed-in-the-wool Trump supporters are the major exception. So what a surprise. In Sunday's New York Times, columnist Nicholas Kristof, famous for traveling the world to enlighten readers about all forms of human misfortune, hunger, disease, war, human rights abuses, he concludes, "We all know the world is going to hell," but then says, "That's wrong." In fact, quote, 2017 was probably the very best year in the long history of humanity. Nicholas Kristof, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Explain yourself.
So you know, I agree with all your listeners that there are so many dangerous aspects of the world today, so many things to worry about. And indeed, every other day of the year, I do worry about them. But I also think it's important to have a larger perspective. And it seems to me that the most important thing happening in our lifetimes is, you know, that when I was born, a majority of humans throughout, since the beginning of time, had always been illiterate and living in extreme poverty. And these days, there are fewer than 15% of people who are illiterate and fewer than 10% who are extremely poor. Last year alone, the number of people who were living in extreme poverty went down by more than 200,000 a day, every day, 217,000 fewer people living in extreme poverty than the year before. Every day, another 300,000 people get access to clean drinking water for the first time. Every day, another 325,000 people get access to electricity for the first time. And so, you know, we indeed have to worry about the mess in Washington. We have to worry about risks of war in North Korea. But I think it's also important to understand that there, you know, there is no magic time in the past, and that maybe the most important thing happening today is not some Trump tweet, but rather kids who are surviving who wouldn't have a year ago or 10 years ago or 30 years ago.
Well, thank you for rescuing us from the Trump tweets, at least for the moment. But it seems to me this is really extraordinary because in the time that you're talking about, since you were born, since I was born, the number of people in the world has increased.
That's right. And so if, I mean, I once on the sort of the back of an envelope calculated that if mortality rates in 1960 had had continued to where they are today with the increase in population, there would be almost 60 million children dying each year before the age of five. And in fact, there are less than 6 million kids who are dying before the age of five each year. So, I mean, it is, you know, it is still unforgivable that there are that many kids dying of often really basic things, of malaria, of diarrhea, of measles, but 90% of that mortality has been reduced because of, again, some pretty basic things like vaccines, like promotion of breastfeeding, like micronutrients, vitamin A supplements, all kinds of things like that. And, you know, and it's not just the deaths that are averted. It's also that fewer people are disabled. Fewer kids have worms. Fewer people are going blind from river blindness or blinding trachoma. There, you know, leprosy is still with us, but it's pretty hard to find cases of leprosy these days, even in the kind of places that I go to.
So the Malthusians are wrong after all?
Yeah, I think they are in a couple of respects. Not only did more population not inevitably cause more famine, in fact, the number of people who are malnourished has gone down, but also the fertility rates are going down very considerably. And it turns out that if you help poor families, if you help their children survive, then they will have fewer children. And so, I mean, I think in Bangladesh right now, if I remember right, the average number of children is just under three. You know,
and what did it used to be?
Oh, more than six.
Wow.
So it's come down more than half. And replacement level to keep a population stable in the long run is just over two. So it's almost at the point where, you know, it will not where it will stabilize. And in the industrialized world, of course, it's below replacement levels. So there's been, you know, there really has been a lot of progress along an awful lot of respects. We, you know, I think also people don't realize that there's been a decline in the number of people dying in wars quite dramatically.
Even though there are more wars?
So interstate wars have basically disappeared. So there are the internal wars, there are civil wars, but you know there have always been wars, and the number of people who were actually dying in these domestic wars. Well, Syria was certainly a tragedy for many years. That actually went down last year somewhat. But the number of people globally dying in wars, whether interstate or civil war, is down very dramatically from what it was in the 1960s, for example.
Give us as an example, as you do in your column, the story of Sultana, because it illustrates somebody who begins in a situation which appears to be without any hope at all and ends up very differently.
That's right. I mean, I think Sultana kind of exemplifies or personifies the changes that I'm talking about in the data. So Sultana is a young Afghan woman who grew up in the Taliban heartland in southern Afghanistan. She was forced by the Taliban to drop out of elementary school in the fifth grade, but her home has internet, and so she was able on her own to teach herself English, and then she's just kind of a math prodigy, and so she then taught herself algebra and calculus and used online classes with things like Coursera and Khan Academy to teach herself more advanced math, to mess around with string theory, and then she began corresponding with a distinguished American professor of astrophysics, Lawrence Krauss, who was kind of amazed to be getting these emails asking about astrophysics from a young woman in Afghanistan. And so I wrote her about her about a year and a half ago, and with the help of my readers and of Professor Krauss, she is now studying in the U.S. And, you know, she will be making real contributions to math and science, whereas, you know, until recently, she would have never had the chance to educate herself in that way. And it's not just Sultana that benefits; it's all the world that benefits. I always think that one of the great aphorisms of the day is that talent is universal, but opportunity is not. And Sultana just exemplifies that aphorism.
So to all of our listeners who are ticking off in their minds all the terrible things that are going on all over the world, you quote Steven Pinker at Harvard saying, "Intellectuals hate progress." Elaborate on that.
Well, I think that, and I've gotten some pushback from the column, and I think it's, there is a sense of discomfort that there are so many things going wrong. And, you know, there are still almost 6 million kids a year who are dying unnecessarily before the age of five. Almost a quarter of kids worldwide are stunted from malnutrition. And this is outrageous. And so there's a reluctance to acknowledge that it's, you know, that there are fewer kids dying, that there are fewer kids malnourished than before. But I think that there's a danger that not acknowledging the progress leaves people feeling kind of helpless and paralyzed and fatalistic about these problems. And I also think that that kind of view empowered the Make America Great forces. When, you know, the truth is, if you look back, there was no period of greatness that we should be nostalgic for. I think that we should be able to basically hold, I quote the, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald about the test of first-rate intelligence is to be able to have two contrary ideas at the same time. And, you know, one is that we have made tremendous progress, and the other is that there's still a long way to go, and the first should empower us to act on the second.
Okay, so you're not suggesting for a moment that we stop being concerned about those things that are wrong, just that we have some perspective and enough perspective, perhaps, to maintain the hopefulness that's required to go forward.
Exactly.
Nicholas Kristof, once again, it's only been a moment of respite, but we are very thankful, as always, to hear from you. Thanks so much.
Good to be with you, Warren.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, available on Apple Podcasts, other podcast platforms, and at kcrw.com/To the Point.